Festival books, their status, purpose, and value.
The following talk, which will be read by Dr. Margaret Schuring, was given by Professor Margaret M. McGowan, CBE, FBA, on the occasion of the formal launch of the British Library Renaissance Festival's website. This audio version of Professor McGowan's talk is introduced by me, Professor Ronnie Mulrine, co-director of the research project which resulted in the creation of the site. Professor McGowan, research professor of French in the University of Sussex, is a distinguished Renaissance and early modern scholar whose numerous publications include Montaigne's Deceits, 1974, Ideal Forms in the Age of Ronsard, 1985, and The Vision of Rome in Late Renaissance France, 2000. Her close interest and pioneering scholarship in dance research has led to books such as L'Art du Ballet de Cœur en France, 1963, The Court Ballet of Louis XIII, 1989, and most recently, Dance in the Renaissance, European Fashion, French Obsession, 2008. Professor McGowan's talk uses the British Library's digitized resource to explore the contribution festivals made to the development of the arts in early modern Europe. She shows how setting them in their social and political contexts offers the possibility of studying the festival's chief performers, patrons, and audience. She also shows how the festival's use of a common language of symbolism reveals their creators' hopes and intentions, demonstrates the evolution of their taste and modes of thought, and exposes the text's limitations as authentic accounts of what actually happened. Professor McGowan focuses on examples from France to illustrate the major trends. The talk is accompanied by 38 illustrations. Clicking on the thumbnails in the text of the talk will allow you to view enlarged images. Alternatively, the enlarged images can be seen by accessing the gallery page relevant to the talk and clicking on the appropriate image. During Dr. Schuring's reading of this audio version, I shall briefly refer to the content of each image as the talk reaches the relevant point. You may like to pause the recording while you look in detail at each of the images. A full listing of the images and their sources at the British Library will be found in the written version of this talk.
Introduction. It is now generally acknowledged that festivals in early modern Europe were a significant cultural and political force. Their records are of enormous value for historians, art historians, scholars interested in the theatre and costume history, and for musicologists and dance historians. In other words, festivals touch on every conceivable aspect of social, political, and cultural history. Recognition of their immense value has always been patchy, but recent scholarly enterprises have begun to make their riches available to a wider audience. There are, for example, the two handsome volumes of Europa Triumphans, published by Ashgate in 2004, which assemble key festival texts of the early modern period from all countries of Europe and from the New World. And now we have this major undertaking, the digitization of some 253 festival books from the British Library's collections. My talk will be illustrated from those holdings, showing how extraordinarily fertile they are and what a marvellous resource for the scholar. I shall try to indicate how they might be studied and exploited for a range of disciplines. An overview of the festival books featured on the British Library's Treasures in Full site. In date, they span more than two centuries, from one of the first printed texts recording the spectacular banquet arranged for a princely marriage in Pesaro in 1475, a banquet which lasted 7.5 hours, during which gods sent the food to the table, to the entry in 1697 of the Elector of Saxony into Krakow. The festivals span many countries and display many national differences, and although the greater number concern festival events in Italy, the collection includes a range of festivals throughout Europe. Indeed, every kind of entertainment is represented. Royal entries, processions, coronations, weddings, baptisms, funerals, princely journeys across Europe, all described in illustrated books that dwell on jousts, simulated naval battles, castle stormings, orations, opera, ballets, masks, performances on ice, and fireworks. There are, for example, divers accounts of the Field of Cloth of Gold in 1520, that magnificent encounter between Henry VIII and François Ier, a diplomatic extravaganza that was, in fact, empty of real political content. There are several pictorial rolls of engravings recording the coronation of Emperor Charles V by the Pope in Bologna in 1530, an occasion on which the church had to be guarded by 4 cannons and 2,000 Spanish troops. If you are interested in princely entries, you will find among these texts Philip of Spain's magnificent entry into Antwerp in 1549 and William III's reception in The Hague in 1691. Baptisms are recorded in splendour, like that of Philip III's firstborn in Valladolid in 1602, and funerals are encountered in profusion, including that of the wife of Philip IV, Signora Donna Isabel de Bourbon, celebrated in Madrid in 1645.
The first illustration shows the funeral pomp laid on for the interment of the wife of Philip IV of Spain. The main altar and the lying in state of the Queen's body are clearly visible.
To give an idea of the range of material, consider this rather stark title vignette prefacing a letter that describes the wedding of Philip II and Mary Tudor in 1554.
In illustration 2, you will see the imperial eagle at the central point, topped by the imperial crown and flanked by the prince's columns and his device plus ultra.
Then there is this frontispiece for the royal entry into Lyon in 1548, where the printer's device is beautifully engraved and seems, momentarily at least, more important than the occasion being recorded.
Illustration 3 shows the title page of a text describing the entry of Henri II into Lyon, with the printer's device given particular prominence.
A different approach is the overview of an event provided at the beginning of an account of the entry of Maria Magdalena, Archduchess of Austria, into Florence, prior to her wedding to Cosimo II in 1608.
In this illustration, illustration 4, the entire entry procession is stretched out, showing also the triumphal arches and monuments erected to greet Maria Magdalena. The meaning of these temporary decorations is briefly indicated in the text below the engraving.
The purpose of festival books. Through a festival book, it is sometimes possible to take in at a glance a complete event, giving the reader a view of the occasion more comprehensive and more detailed than any mere spectators could have gained, even when they had actually witnessed the entry. Festival books were, moreover, designed in part to allow the principal actors the opportunity to experience again an important occasion in their lives, and to understand more fully the meaning of the symbols that had been laid on the surface of the monuments. The books also served as memorials to noble participants who could recall in later life the splendour of past deeds, like the Lord Great Chamberlain's appearance at the head of the great line of officials who led James II at the opening of Parliament in 1685.
Illustration 5 shows in colour the Lord Chamberlain's 1685 procession to Parliament.
The Lord Chamberlain was in charge of all royal ceremonial, and it was he who masterminded the same king's coronation 2 years later. One can gauge the nature of the complex arrangements required from this view of the moment of crowning at Westminster.
You can see in Illustration 6 the vast spaces of the Abbey, faithfully rendered by the artist, with the scaffolds erected for spectators, the whole composition projecting an extraordinary calm and sense of order.
The same qualities are found in a static vision of the banquet which followed the coronation, given in Westminster Hall.
The engraving, Illustration 7, shows the diners at long tables, as well as spectators who had paid entrance money to see them eat. One can admire, too, the careful delineation of the handsome beams of this old ceremonial place.
A final image from this event illustrates well the kind of aspirations that creators of festivals struggled to project for even the weakest of monarchs.
In this fireworks display over the Thames, Illustration 8, James is shown as the Sun King, perhaps rivaling the status of Louis XIV, with, opposite him, the figure of a Roman knight bearing the king's laurel crown.
These are undoubtedly images of power and authority. They are, however, expressed in flames, which were quickly to fade, and which disappeared altogether through the ineptitude of this sensuous, pleasure-seeking monarch. As William Cavendish, Duke of Newcastle, wrote to James's predecessor, "For what preserves you, kings, more than ceremony?" Certainly we know of the ambitious hopes which were never fulfilled, though eloquently projected in this record of the festival. The idealising content of festivals. James II's coronation record provides some idea of the idealising nature of these forms. The ceremony itself, and the symbolic, hyperbolic structures around it, painted figures larger than life. Similarly, in the entry prepared for Maria de Medici into Paris in 1610, her husband, Henry IV, was deliberately painted as something above and beyond a simple man. "The idea of him as king could not be conceived or understood," wrote Mathurin Regnier, the inventor of the show, "sans imaginer quelque chose au-dessus de l'homme." The thematic structure of this entry, therefore, was founded upon ideas such as exaltation, praise, glory, and exhibition. By the display of greatness, inventors of festivals hoped to teach their princes to emulate what they saw, and to remind them of past achievements, which might be repeated in the future. Thus, in 1589, the history of good government in Florence, the splendid dynasties of the Lorraine and Medici families and their victorious military histories are displayed on the arches erected for the entry of Christine de Lorraine.
Illustration 9 shows the first arch, which, through its symbolic images, demonstrates the history of good government in the city. The second arch, Illustration 10, includes a series of canvases representing the dynasties of Lorraine and Medici. In the canvas shown here, Catherine de Medici and her family are depicted. The military history of the two houses since the First Crusade was represented on the third arch.
The Jesuit Order. Inventors of festivals were equally ambitious for themselves as they were for the princes they served, for they recognized that their own status was closely allied to the lofty roles they created for their patrons. From the mid-16th century, into this arena came the Jesuits, who saw the enormous advantages for their order in getting close to princes by praising them in their works. One of the most astonishing displays of their ingenuity and inventive powers can be seen in the royal entry they organized into Avignon in 1623 to greet Louis XIII after his series of victories over the Protestants. One might venture to say that their designs were preposterous in their complexity.
In this arch, illustration 11, the structures seem to have grown sideways.
You can still see today the simple double-columned arch at the centre, but excrescences have developed on either side, adding new structures and numerous statues and pictures which make up the surviving portal of felicity.
This festival structure was glued, illustration 12, onto the façade of the cathedral, an immense building decorated with saintly images surrounding and overwhelming the tiny arch placed at the beginning of a deep perspective leading into the church.
Festival book illustrations. The work of artists did not end with the festival. They were often needed to contribute to the official record that was intended to impress a wider community. The visual material in particular could be of rare quality. In 1633, for instance, when the Chancellor of Poland, Jerzy Ossolinski, visited the Pope, Stefano della Bella wrought an intricate engraving, filling the space with an astonishing number of figures, suggesting the landscape behind and indicating something of the monumentality of Rome, with the stone monument carved on the left.
The Stefano della Bella engraving is shown in illustration 13, with its elaborate design and multiple figures. This next scene, by an unknown artist, illustration 14, shows a fortress at the centre, with squadrons of riders drawn up ready to perform, while some others are engaged in action. The tiny figures and their movements have been clearly captured by the artist's pen.
Some of the most remarkable drawings in a festival book are those created by Jacques Callot, where he strove to capture not only the detail of the figures, but also to give life to the simulacra of their action. His book related the tournament and horse ballet devised in February 1616 to entertain the court at Florence. In a succession of sketches interwoven between prose descriptions of the activities, Callot renders minutely the forward movement of Lucinda's triumphal chariot, drawing in the margin, in slightly larger form, the figure of one of her attendants.
The attendant is shown in illustration 15. Illustration 16 shows the chariot of the pageant figure Africa, characterized by activity similar to that of the chariot of Lucinda.
Following these, you can see the first of a series of 16 engravings giving aerial views of the horse ballet. On the first page, the initial positions of the knights are illustrated.
In this further illustration, illustration 17, you can observe how radically the movement changes within a short space of time.
These engravings give an idea of the intricate nature of horse and rider. It is not surprising that such horse ballets took months to prepare and demonstrated the skills both of the knights and their mounts. Illustrations and heritage. From the images so far seen, you will have noted how these festival records might appeal to the historian and to scholars of the theatre and of art. They have additionally a wider interest to anyone concerned with the cultural heritage of the Renaissance. This was a time when humanism had brought enhanced knowledge of classical forms and ways of thinking. Poets and artists in particular seized on this new information, which was conveniently accessible in Renaissance dictionaries of myths and symbols, and in books of emblems and devices. With this material, they adorned their inventions covering them with images and symbols, so that triumphant arches, for example, had interpretative and pedagogic functions, and often left commentators with a happy abundance of different ways to explain the symbolism. When the Jesuits got hold of them, they let their imaginations run riot. Handbooks of myths and symbols were not followed slavishly, but they provided new ways of presenting ideas. In time, festival books themselves became sources for manipulation by later inventors. Vincenzo Borghini, for instance, who conceived the whole plan of the festival devised to celebrate the marriage of Francesco de' Medici with Joanna of Austria in 1565, systematically consulted descriptions of festivals and triumphal entries from all over Europe, as well as studying classical imagery at first hand, so that he might incorporate authentic images into the many medallions he used for his decorative program. Spectators and readers. Borghini's approach, shared by many other poets and artists, inevitably raises questions about how far spectators and readers were able to fathom the meaning of the symbols that confronted them. In some ways, festival books themselves provide answers. They explained the images, discussed their import, and spelled out their application to present affairs. In addition, great artists were often involved, and the boldness and clarity of their designs aided understanding. Leonardo da Vinci invented the floats that processed through Florence in 1515 at the coming of the Pope. 1,726 artists were employed to stage the entry for Prince Philip into Antwerp in 1549. Bronzino and Giorgio Vasari invented the machines to celebrate the wedding of the Duke at Florence in 1565. Archimboldo masterminded the festivals for a royal wedding in Vienna in 1572. And Peter Paul Rubens designed all the fabulous arches in Antwerp in 1635 for the Archduke's entry. Images from antiquity. All these artists dipped into their classical and local heritage, borrowing forms of triumph and models from antiquity. The influence of Rome can be detected in all triumphal entries. An especially striking example of this is the entry of Archduke Ernst into Antwerp in 1594, where a copy of the Colosseum was used to depict the Theatre of Peace.
Illustration 18 shows an exterior view of the monument in Antwerp. Illustration 19 shows the same monument opened up to reveal the figure of Concord.
Roman influence is also evident in the use of obelisks, commemorative plaques, and in the many transformations of the triumphal chariot which had carried Caesar into Rome to receive the acclamations of the crowd after his numerous victories. Mantegna had made familiar this vision of the emperor erect in his car, surrounded by trophies of the battles he had won, and followed by the dejected kings he had humbled. Renaissance artists played with this form, and by the end of the 16th century, although obviously still recognizable as a triumphal chariot, efforts had been made to make the chariot even more spectacular. Elephants and carriage wheels in the form of the sun, for example, brought in Persian knights for the wedding of the Duke in Florence in 1579.
Illustration 20 shows these spectacular figures as they were modelled in 1579 for the wedding of Francesco I and Bianca Capello.
For the same event, Mars was drawn in by two shaggy lions.
Here, illustration 21, the god of war is shown standing on a figure representing a langoustine or lobster. In 1616, at a staged opera in Florence, a great rock, drawn by horses, supported Atlas and the world. Illustration 22 shows the entry of the sun. At La Rochelle in 1636, illustration 23, even the Roman circus has been crammed onto a triumphal car.
Visual spectacle. As architects and stage designers' skills developed, they amazed audiences at festivals with the visual feats they contrived. Fireworks in the open air with spectators at a safe distance were common throughout Europe. In 1613, over the river at Heidelberg, fireworks lit up the sky for the wedding of the Elector Palatine. Castles filled with explosives were situated in the middle, with groups standing on the riverbanks observing the show.
Illustration 24 shows the scene of the fireworks at Heidelberg.
Even more spectacular were the festivities at Versailles in 1674, which ended with the blowing up of the palace of the enchantress Alcina.
In illustration 25, you can see the royal family and the court comfortably accommodated around the edge of the lake during the destruction of Alcina's palace.
The scene was engraved by Israel Silvestre, who had recorded the entire series of fêtes at Versailles from 1664 to 1678, and whose work became so famous that the plates were published and sold in separate editions. Audiences. The relationship of audience and spectacle was one of distance, where the emotions were played upon by ingenious machines which sought to create startled astonishment. The relationship was similar in indoor festivals. The narrator of the London celebrations in 1613, for instance, praised the masque for its spectacular scenes and wrote, "The stars moved in an exceeding strange and delightful manner, and I suppose few had seen more neat artifice than Master Inigo Jones showed in contriving their motion." By the 17th century, the nature and sequence of such scenes of illusion were pretty well fixed. The operas, ballets, and masques required at least four standard sets: a seascape, a forest scene, a vision of hell, and the spectacle of heaven peopled by gods and choirs of celestial beings.
This illustration, illustration 26, shows a typical forest scene as stage for a ballet at Celle in 1653. Illustration 27 shows a moderately tranquil vision of hell, conjured up for an opera at Parma in 1628 to celebrate the marriage of Odoardo Farnese.
Multiple examples of elaborate scenes of illusion can be found in these books. Their ambitious character is well conveyed in illustrations of a staged tournament at Ferrara in 1631.
Illustration 28 shows a representative scene.
Mars and Discord descend towards a stage where cloud and flames surround them. They intend to sow the seeds of the war that will initiate the action.
A second scene, illustration 29, shows three knights in extraordinary garb entering with their pages to defend the cause of peace.
These are perhaps the most extravagant headdresses ever worn by beings intending to fight. One wonders how the central figure managed to move at all. Clearly, for this festival, there was scarcely room on stage for other performers, yet the theatre could often be cluttered up with princes who wanted to be close to the action, as in the climax to the opera in Vienna in 1652, celebrating the birth of the Spanish Infanta.
This engraving of the scene, illustration 30, shows the emperor and his son Leopold, King of Hungary, installed on the stage in fair proximity to the fighting that was about to break out.
It is worth noting in passing the enormous audience closely packed, as it were, into the stalls and balcony. Music and dance. These festivals were marvels of organisation, achieved through collaboration and remarkable coordination of artists, poets, musicians, choreographers, fencing masters, noble and professional performers, and, of course, administrative experts. We do not have time during the present talk to study the value of festival books for the history of music and dance. The books are formidably important for these purposes. These three images from the ballet performed at Celle in 1653 will provide a taste of the kind of activity spectators enjoyed, including grotesque as well as noble dancing.
The first of these illustrations, illustration 31, presents dancers disguised as bears, performing a torch dance. Illustration 32 shows the grotesque dancing and costuming of four fools. The third of these illustrations, illustration 33, depicts a grand ballet of 12 soldiers engaged in a kind of Pyrrhic dance.
Creators and narrators. Although it is true that in early modern Europe festivals were obvious examples of conspicuous consumption by the upper echelons of society, creators and narrators of these events rarely saw them as straightforward reflections of established hierarchies. Antoine de Laval, for example, writing an account of the entry of Henri IV into Moulins in 1595, was as much preoccupied with the projection of his own scholarly image as with an explanation of the symbolism devised for the king's benefit. He complained at the necessity of translating his Greek and Latin texts into the vulgar tongue so that common readers, common is his word, might penetrate his meaning. Participants. In masks at court, when a king like James I did not perform himself, courtiers strove to impress him with their ingenuity and skill. They lobbied for attention, demonstrating their loyalty, and sometimes, as in the case of the Duke of Buckingham, they succeeded in gaining favour through their superlative dancing. Most records list the names of participants, so that the community at large might recognize their important status at court. During royal entries, power relations were made plain through time-honored gestures and words. Although coronations might be regarded as proof of dynastic continuity, entries were more complex. The chief performers demonstrated a balance of power between the monarch, who, through the symbolism exalting his name and deeds, received recognition of his authority, and the citizens, the merchants who had usually paid for the splendour, who filed in great numbers before the king, demonstrating their strength and a desire that their civic privileges be renewed. The crowd. On these occasions, the presence of the people could also be heard. A crowd of 7,000 greeted Henri II as he went through the city gates at Lyon in 1548. In the Low Countries, the clamour of the people was heard at Bruges in 1515, appealing to the young Prince Charles to reinvigorate the city and its trade. At Antwerp in 1594, the Theatre of Peace, which, as we've seen in illustrations 18 and 19, so resembled the Colosseum, offered a visual reminder and plea from the townspeople that the wars that had devastated their country for so long might cease. In German states, at Halle in 1616, for example, peasants were participants in the revelry. Over 120 of them joined in the procession, tumbling as they went and carrying sheaves of corn and farm implements. Occasionally, though, the populace was not quiescent. After the Duc d'Anjou had left an elaborately contrived garden filled with elegant statues, wrought in ancient fashion, at the centre of Tours in 1576, the crowd came in and pillaged, ravaged, and ransacked, despite the guards posted all around. The importance of context. Such checks notwithstanding, festivals were significant contributions to political debate, and to understand their meaning fully, each festival book needs to be set within its immediate context. At Toulouse in 1565, for example, Charles IX's entry was marked by an emphasis on local history, with the inventor of the arches going back to old volumes of annals and to Plutarch and Strabo. New dynasties sought to reinforce their claims to legitimacy, as in Emperor Ferdinand I's entry into Prague in 1558, or that of Sigismund III into Krakow 30 years later. The marriage celebrations of the Elector Palatine in 1613 were the culmination of years of political manoeuvrings and gatherings among Protestant princes, who had wished in their festivals to make visual statements about war and peace and national identity, as well as expressing their hopes for unity. The tour of northern Italian cities by Henri III on his return to France from Krakow in 1574 was greeted with a remarkable series of festivals given by princes anxious to have a powerful monarch's support. Even Venice, that standard-bearer of freedom and republicanism, entertained him for many days. In ballets and operas, too, there was the same concern to make political statements. The opening scene of the opera put on in Florence in 1637 to celebrate the Duke's wedding projected a view of Florence, thus inviting spectators to recognize the significance of the city as an element in the drama.
Illustration 34 shows the opera's first scene, with its view of the city of Florence.
In general, very precise political motives directed the themes, images, and verses of a spectacle, and these were especially emphasized in the printed record. At Caen, in 1532, François Ier was left in no doubt as to what the city wanted: equal status with rival towns in Normandy. The Duc de Nevers' secretary, Blaise de Vigenières, in his published version of the entry of Henri III into Mantua in 1574, reworked the chosen images, manipulating their meaning in order to cement closer political relations between his master and the king. Henri IV observed the legitimate line of the Bourbons displayed at Lyon in 1595, and in the same year that the citizens of Abbeville seized the opportunity of the king's entry to put into relief his role as Catholic monarch at a time when the Pope had still to pronounce absolution for his alleged apostasy. How far are festival books authentic records of what went on? Of course, we should not expect them to be accurate, since publication, which was mostly after the event, gave their inventors the opportunity to spend several weeks, and sometimes months, polishing and shaping the record, inserting erudition, engravings, or woodcuts. Essentially, festival books are records of aspiration. Their images indicate what the spectator was supposed to see. The timescale for production of the actual event was often ridiculously short. At Narbonne in 1565, the citizens had thought the king would stay 3 or 4 days, but he decided to leave on the morrow, and the decorations they had planned had to be put up in a few hours. Sometimes the projected monuments were not even put up at all, as Pierre Mathieu admitted, for the entries into Lyon in 1595 and 1600. Although he made sure that they were fully represented in prose and in image in the printed text. In addition, narrators were not always confident that their words were adequate to express the precise form of the buildings which were erected, and so they had recourse to illustrations, as, for example, in Bouquet's description of Charles IX's entry into his capital city in 1571. At the summit of a vast perspective built in front of the Pont de Paris, was erected a double balustrade, suggesting, from the ladies that could be seen there, that there was actually a pathway, whereas the effect had really been managed by skilful illusionist techniques.
The illustration, illustration 35, shows the Pont de Paris in long perspective, with the illusionist elements clearly depicted.
We must not always believe what is said in festival books. Let us take as one example among many the record of the festivities at Binche in 1549, where recourse to mysterious themes made up of myth, folklore and magic have long fascinated scholarly commentators. The future king of Spain, Philip II, on his way to his kingdom in the Netherlands, was entertained to several days of tournaments, feats of arms, adventures, ballets and banquets, all reminiscent of an earlier era when knights set out on their quest for the golden sword or the adventure of the dark castle, or when Prince Philip sat alone at table enjoying his food.
Illustrations 36, 37 and 38 are woodcuts representing the three episodes of the golden sword, the dark castle and Prince Philip alone at table.
In fact, these woodcuts, and all the others in this record allegedly illustrating the festival at Binche, are, in reality, Hans Schauflein's woodcuts for the Teuerdank, a magnificent volume commissioned by Maximilian I and published in 1517. In that book, the emperor advertised his feats of arms and showed himself and his court engaged in splendid ceremonial. And it is he, Emperor Maximilian, who sits alone at table in the woodcut, and not Prince Philip. But it is unlikely that many, if any, contemporaries were aware of this. The purpose and significance of festival books. In conclusion, we should ask, why were such records created? Some were, of course, standard reports of ambassadors to their princes. Others were official records published by town councils to preserve for posterity the splendour and generosity of their cities. Others were published as reminders to princes of their obligations, like the series of entries created for the future Philip II into the Low Countries in the mid-16th century. The records might be lavish productions, such as those issued by order of Louis XIV to mark his supremacy in magnificence over all other princes in Europe. Others were distinctive political contributions, declaring to the world that courts were in close alliance with each other, such as the German princes in the first decade of the 17th century. Whatever the purpose of festival books, they merit serious study. They were frequently illustrated by expert and sometimes great artists, Stefano Della Bella, Jacques Callot, Israel Silvestre. Bibliographically, they are significant, often representing major productions by famous printers like Antonio Blado in Rome, Christophe Plantin in Antwerp, Guillaume Roville in Lyon, or Robert Ballard in Paris. Moreover, they afford insights into key dynastic events, but also, it must be stressed, into historical psychology. Many of these volumes are extremely rare, and the convenience and ease of access made possible by a project such as Renaissance Festival Books is of incontrovertible value. Truth or fiction, imaginary triumphs or real events, or something of both, these books are self-conscious fabrications which reveal dedication to record-making and rare imaginative powers.